This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek is out, is on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, always, of course, on the Bloomberg terminal. And in it, a few stories about today's financial market environment. Tim and I teased it a little bit earlier. One is on the dollar, which we'll get into later. That's the cover story. But there's also another one on how Fed Chief Jay Powell knows he's inflicting pain on investors and how it's really needed to help get inflation down, Tim.
Yeah, the piece by Ed Harrison, senior markets editor for Bloomberg News. Ed, this afternoon, joining us via Zoom from Washington, D.C. Ed, what I really like about this piece is it takes a historical look at what the Fed has done with interest rates or what it hasn't done with interest rates, especially since the financial crisis. Where are we right now on the Fed's path to raising rates and bringing inflation under control?
Yeah, it looks like we're at peak hawkishness right now, but we're getting back to where we were before the great financial crisis. That whole period between 2007 and 2022 was a 15-year period of what Larry Summers has been calling secular stagnation, where interest rates were well below where they could have been in other periods, mostly because inflation was low. But now that inflation has come back, we're going back to a much more normal environment. But we're almost at the end of this particular hiking cycle. I think we probably have 6 to 9 months at most.
You speak about this cycle and this environment that includes, you know, companies cutting workers and just crossing the Bloomberg terminal, Meta announcing a hiring freeze, warning employees of a restructuring. And I'm looking at Meta's shares falling to session lows today. They've been under pressure, but now near their lows of the session. That means they're down about 4.3%. We'll have more on that news. By the way, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg announcing this freeze at a meeting with employees. He also says the moves are aimed at cutting costs and shifting priorities. And maybe no surprises, this company has even renamed itself, as we know, from Facebook to Meta. We're still talking with Ed Harrison, senior markets editor at Bloomberg News. There's a story, there's a line in your story, Ed, that says the Fed won't come out and say it, but when members of the Fed's board of governors see this reaction in terms of assets and the prices of assets coming down, they're probably pleased. I mean, this is what they need to see to happen to kind of rein everything in, correct?
100%, because, you know, basically every Fed meeting that we saw in the last three or four meetings before the most recent one, we saw the markets go up when the Fed came out. So the Fed came out with relatively hawkish terminology, and then Jay Powell got talking and people said, you know, wait a minute, he's not as hawkish as we thought. And so stocks rallied. That makes the Fed's ability to tighten policy more difficult because they're working through the financial sector in order to have any impact on the real economy.
Ed, what happens on the other side of this when we do see the Fed pause rates or even start to cut rates at a certain point, when we do see inflation come down? How does that change what investors really should be prepared for?
It all depends on how late the Fed is in recognizing that inflation's coming down, and how sticky inflation is in terms of, you know, how much deceleration we get in the real economy by the time it goes there. I think that we're already seeing this deceleration. You know, this thing about Meta, it shows you that it's starting to move out. We're seeing retail. We're seeing technology, we're seeing housing impacted, and soon, eventually, it's going to seep into the services sector as well. And at that point, it'll be too late for the Fed to make any differences. They'll have to be ahead of that. They'll have to know that their policy is acting with a lag. And I think that if they don't, the impact could be a lot more severe.
Hey, Ed, how much of this is, you know, we all keep doing as a reference the 2008 financial crisis. Where we are today is not the same as where we were in 08. But, you know, the Fed had to be watching, right, everybody's personal balance sheets as the market came undone. I certainly was watching mine. And cheap money, bringing rates down to nothing, certainly helped that out ultimately.
Yeah, you know, that is an interesting question, because I think that the housing peak was probably 2005 in terms of actual prices and turnover. But then it wasn't until 2007 that we got the ructions in the financial markets. All of that's happening in a very compressed way, partially because the Fed is moving so aggressively relative to what they were doing in 2007. So I think Larry Summers said earlier today, it's like August 2007. Probably that's about right, that we're in the 2007 timeframe. So that means that if the Fed continues at the pace that it's going now, it's going to cause something to break, and then we'll quickly be into the 2008 period.
All right, we got to run. Hey, Ed Harrison, thank you so much. Such a relevant story. Senior markets editor at Bloomberg News, joining us via Zoom from Washington, D.C. All right, want to get back to that breaking news, a Bloomberg exclusive. Meta Platforms, the owner of Facebook and Instagram, saying it will freeze hiring and restructure some teams in an effort to cut costs and shift priorities. This is coming directly from the company's CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, announcing that in a meeting in a Q&A session with employees, according to someone who was there. Shares of Meta now down about 4%. So let's get to it and let's get more.
Yeah, we bring in Bloomberg News executive editor Tom Giles, who joins us on the phone from San Francisco. Tom, what does our investing audience need to understand about what Meta Platforms is doing in terms of restructuring and freezing hiring?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. So this is a meeting that's happening in real time. We're getting a read from folks in the room. What Mark Zuckerberg has said is that the macro economy remains tough and volatile. That's a quote. Meta is going to focus on a small number of high priority growth areas. This is really about them having to shift priorities and focus. They're going to be shrinking some teams. Other teams may get more resources. This is a big restructuring that Mark Zuckerberg is talking about. He told people in the meeting that we had thought that things would stabilize in the economy, but that's not happening. He is basically saying again, given the volatile macro economy, we need to make some hard choices.
Well, help us read into that, Tom, because sure. This is also coming at a time when Meta Platforms is going through a huge shift in what it was. It's
right.
The biggest
right.
shift that the company's ever made. I mean, it lost invested $10 billion on its transition into the metaverse.
Yes,
how much
geez.
Of this is specific to Meta Platforms versus the actual economy? I mean, because TikTok is, you know, eating Facebook's lunch right now.
You know, in his comments, we haven't heard him mention TikTok, but you're correct in that historically they have spoken about TikTok in the past as being a threat to them. They haven't used that word, but that's exactly what it is. Young people are spending more and more time on TikTok and less time on places like Facebook, the social network, or even to some degree Instagram. So, you know, social networks are all having to look over their shoulder, and every time they do, they see TikTok there gaining and gaining and gaining. That's the backdrop here. Again, that's not something that he talked about here. But you're right also that several months ago, Mark Zuckerberg said that we are going to double down on the metaverse. That's this idea, this new conception of what it will be like to be online. And and it's going to be an immersive experience. It's going to be something where, you know, they're looking to capitalize out on that in a lot of ways, including AR headsets, VR headsets that will, you know, let you kind of delve into the metaverse. The idea in the long term is that there could be a whole new way of interacting socially in the metaverse. There'll be a whole new, you know, kind of paradigm for e-commerce, but that stuff is really down the road. In the short term, that's where you're seeing Facebook take experience a lot of pain.
Right.
And, you know, $10 billion is a lot of money to invest over the long haul.
Tom, it's really interesting that you say that. I feel like so many of the executives or investors that we have here on at Bloomberg, somehow we end up coming around to either crypto and or Meta and the metaverse. And we have the Pearson PLC CEO coming up, Educational Publishing. We're going to talk to him about that. Like, what's the impact of the metaverse on the educational
sure.
publishing world? Is this just a case, and could it be 5 years from now, longer, shorter, perhaps, that this is a company that understands its market has changed dramatically, and they've got to start making the investments, hiring the right people to make sure that they are still around 5 years from now and that they're relevant? It's not different from the automakers, right, who've had to make some tremendous shifts as well, or are in the process of.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the fact of it remains that the metaverse is a very unproven concept. You know, car makers like Tesla have demonstrated that you can succeed at electric vehicles, and that there's a market for that. The risk that Meta is taking is that the metaverse isn't real, at least mm-hmm. not yet. And will people, you know, is this something that people want? Is this something that people have asked for? And we've experimented with versions of the metaverse in the past. Look at Second Life. It was hot for about 5 minutes, metaphorically speaking, and nothing, you know, it's not anymore. There's a lot riding on this. Meta has a lot of, has a lot at stake in order to get this right. And so the reprioritization of their teams makes a lot of sense in light of that. And when you add on to the fact that we're not sure about, how bad inflation is going to get, we're not sure about, a recession or how deep it may get. You add those together and you add the competitive pressure that they're feeling from TikTok. That's why Mark Zuckerberg is sharing, this message with his staff at this moment.
All right. Incredible stuff. And as we said, a Bloomberg exclusive. Tom Giles, thank you so much. Bloomberg News executive editor joining us on the phone from San Francisco. Tom mentioned it's a live meeting. It's happening now. We're getting reports from someone in the room. The big headline, Meta announcing a hiring freeze, warning employees of restructuring. They did kind of hint at this very clearly over the summer. Here's some of the newest headlines. The Meta CEO are talking about focusing on a small number of high priority growth areas. Meta will end 2023 as, quote, somewhat smaller organization, and the Meta CEO telling its staff budget to be tight, quote, across all teams.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We haven't forgotten about the pandemic and also the consequences of the pandemic and what it said about the healthcare system and the safety net when it comes to healthcare here in the United States. For that, we have a great guest this afternoon. We have Dr. Daryl Gaskin, professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Gaskin joining us this afternoon on the phone from Baltimore. The Bloomberg School of Public Health, it is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, the founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Gaskin, it's good to have you with us this afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's good to be on.
Well, can you talk a little bit about how we're thinking about the safety net when it comes to medical care in this country? For a large portion of the pandemic, we did see the federal government step in and provide assistance, especially as it did relate to the pandemic. But now, as the president has said, the pandemic is over, there are concerns about how funding for that will continue. Where do you stand?
Well, one of the things that the pandemic revealed is that our current safety net is inadequate. When we saw those disparities in both infection rates and in deaths among minority populations, one of the reasons why we saw so many severe cases and people dying was because of the inadequacy of the safety net to sort of deal with the stress of the pandemic. So whether or not you got in an ICU that had a ventilator and had all the resources that were needed to handle the disease really, in a real sense, determined whether you were able to survive COVID or whether you died from it. And there have been studies that have shown that once you control for where people went to get their care, some of the disparities we see, especially in mortality, that it went away. And it was really about where you got your care as opposed to sort of who was receiving the care.
You know, what's interesting too, Dr. Gaskin, is, and just this week, our Bloomberg Anna Edney reporting on how private equity piled records amount of money into healthcare companies last year. I think Bain & Company put out a number that total healthcare investment more than doubled last year to $151 billion from $66 billion the year before. I think COVID kind of was like everybody reminding, oh, wait, healthcare, good investment. But her reporting also saying that it may not be good for patients, resulting in higher prices and the quality of care going down. You know, we already know this. The pandemic revealed it again, that there are already health disparities, as you were talking about, in our system that impact some communities more than other. So what reduces those gaps the most?
Well, I think one of the major problems is that while we have a lot of investment in healthcare, and while we spend close to 18-19% of our economy on healthcare, the allocation of resources is really not very well correlated with disease and the incidence of disease in our country. So, the people who need the care the most are not often getting it, and then people who are receiving a lot of care often are probably receiving too much. Now, I've often said if we really want to get health care right in this country, we're going to have to learn how to say yes to some people who we've been saying no to and say no to some people who we're saying yes to, because the marginal benefit of the care in which those persons are receiving is really not worth the cost that society is paying.
Who are those people, Dr. Gaskin?
That you say no to.
it's sort of like while for patients, for instance, sometimes people will advertise getting an MRI for you. You don't have any real symptoms, but they want to give you like a full body makeup of what's happening for you in with regard to your health, to sort of give you some prognosis and assure you. Now, for the individual, that might feel very good to get that, but as a use of a, sort of an MRI for healthcare for the society, it's probably not the best use of it. It's a very costly machine to maintain, and so there are a lot of patients who are receiving care like that, sort of low-value care, is the way in which we sort of term it in health services research, are receiving these low-value care. It sort of makes us feel emotionally good, but in terms of sort of improving our overall health, it probably is not doing very much.
Does it worry you about the amount of investment money? We just talked about private equity money that's in healthcare.
No, but it does worry me with regard to, for instance, that there are patients who could use those services who are not able to access them. Mm. So one of the things that I often point out is that with Medicaid, what we do with Medicaid is we provide people with coverage, but then we pay the providers 50 cents on the dollar. And it would be just like if we took our food stamps program, mm-hmm. and we told the grocer that we're going to let poor people buy bread, but we're only going to pay you half the price for it. And so then what that means is that grocers are not going to really want to serve or provide services or provide a lot of services to poor people because they're just not able to meet their costs. And the same thing happens in healthcare, in that we essentially we cover mm-hmm. our poor people, but we don't pay for them.
Yeah.
And as a result, in places where there are lots of poor people, you have inadequate services. So while we might be building stuff, we're just not building it all in the right places.
Hey, Dr. Gashkin, just very briefly before we go, what's the federal government's role in this?
Well, the federal government's got a major role because the federal government finances the Medicare program and then also jointly finances the Medicaid program with the state. And so at some point, what we would hope is that the kinds of reimbursement that we see in the Medicare program, we'd also would see in the Medicaid program. And then that, in some ways, will allow the market to adjust. I mean, so when the patient who's covered by Medicaid walks into the physician office or walks in the hospital with the same sort of purchasing power as the
right.
patient Medicare, then the market will adjust and,
right.
and will honor that patient. But as long as we allow this sort of discrimination, it's called price discrimination, the way economists call it, where you have some people with a lot of purchasing power and a whole bunch of people with not very
yeah.
much purchasing power,
right.
then you get this maldistribution of resources.
I think that certainly would resonate with the Bloomberg audience. We get that when you throw in that financial incentive or lack thereof. Dr. Daryl Gashkin, thank you so much. Professor of Health Policy and Management at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, of course, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies, on the phone from Baltimore.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
You know, the dollar, a problem for the world, and apparently the U.S. just doesn't care. Take that, everyone. This is the cover story of Bloomberg Business Week, the new issue. It is out on newsstands, on the Bloomberg, and online. So let's get to it. And we've got a great reporter.
Yeah, we do. We got Liz McCormick joining us. She's bond and FX reporter for Bloomberg News. She's on the byline for this fantastic story. As Carol mentioned, it is on the cover of the new issue of Business Week magazine. It's available on newsstands, on the Bloomberg terminal, and of course at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. So Liz, let's just start with the basics here. We know the dollar is strong, especially against every other currency that's out there right now, pretty much. Why is that an issue for the rest of the world?
Well, think about it. The whole world has this major inflation problem, right? Of course, that's why the Fed is focused on tightening, and that's why we have such a strong dollar, among some other reasons. But all these other countries have this historic inflation as well, and their currencies weakening actually lifts inflation, you know, because it, you know, brings up import prices, and it's inflationary. So it's kind of the exact thing they don't want, you know. So, you know, in the old days, we'd have currency wars. Everyone wanted a stronger currency. Now people would like a weaker one, you know, but everybody can't, you know, currencies, there's a pairs, right? So somebody's got to win, and the dollar's winning all over.
Well, and it's interesting, too. You're right. I feel like the dollar is not just the financial markets, but it's such a like geopolitical, I feel like, instrument, if you will. Jay Powell and the FOMC spend a lot of time. Do they in terms of looking at the dollar and the impact. We talked, you know, we had Loretta Mester earlier coming out, making a comment and saying basically, you know, we got to keep on raising rates, even if there's a recession. Yeah. So you do wonder what that Fed is like. Well, sorry, guys, we got to keep doing this. We don't care what happens.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they, you know, there, I think it was the Fed's Bostic who, similar to Mester, was talking about, you know, we have to stay the course on inflation. And we're, like, we're aware of what's going on. You know, the UK markets, if it reverberated, it could cause some weakness. But basically, we've got a job to do, right? Inflation is too high. We have to plow onward with raising rates. So, you know, it was Stephen Roach I was talking to for this story. You guys know him.
Yes.
And he said to me, yeah, Liz, it reminds me of Connolly. You know, these guys have been around for a long time. Former Treasury Secretary. And he famously said, listen, the dollar is our currency and your problem. And this is, if, you know, a super good case of that because, you know, and you know, the Fed is feeling bad because they were so far behind, right?
Right.
You know, kind of kept rates and stuff too low. And so I think they're like, listen, we just can't risk any more slip ups, right? So we got to keep tightening. But it is causing a lot of pain globally. And it might be good for U.S. travelers abroad. But yeah, otherwise than that, it's just kind of causing a lot of problems.
Liz, I do feel like we have a theme today because we talked earlier about that the Fed, you know, okay, if we're inflicting pain on investors in the public markets, financial markets, because that will help them in their inflation fight. And that's the same thing, right? A strong dollar could actually help them in their fight against inflation. Can you explain that?
Well, right, because, well, a couple things. People usually say the U.S. is exporting inflation, right? But also, think about U.S. companies. You were talking about Meta and all the companies. They all do a lot abroad. So in a sense, it slows the economy. It's a little bit of a headwind. Our good, you know, these companies selling abroad, their products are a little more costly. So in general, it adds to what we know the Fed wants to tighten financial conditions, which can happen through higher rates, lower, you know, wider credit spreads, lower equity valuations, and a stronger dollar. So it is one of the kind of, I call it, it's like an amalgam of things that are part of financial conditions, but a stronger dollar does do that, a kind of a headwind to growth. And that's what the Fed's trying to do, right? Slow things down.
Yeah, I think we got the message, right?
The markets certainly have. So
right.
The question is, you know, how much more tightening does there actually need to be to get inflation under control? What about from the perspective of developing economies and paying back debt and the effect that this has on the entire world?
Well, yeah, that's a real problem because, you know, if your rates are higher, because part of some of these countries have had to step up the pace of their interest rate hikes, right, to try to keep up with the Fed. I mean, like we said, many of them have their own inflation problem, but have had to almost try to kind of keep up. So higher rates mean, and it's happening to the U.S. too, you're all paying back debt at a higher level. But if they have to pay back in dollars like you're getting to, it's harder to get that many dollars, right? Mm-hmm. So it's costing them more to pay if they have dollar denominated debt. So it can go in a various tentacles that hurt them for sure.
Do we have to be worried, Liz, about, you know, we've seen this in the past, right? You talk about history. Was it back in 85? In your story, you talk about the Plaza Accord. I mean, do we have to be worried, though, about other nations working in agreement together to counter that strong U.S. dollar?
Well, of course, some are trying in unison. Like, you know, you guys have talked many times about the Bank of Japan, which had came in and intervened kind of unilaterally, trying to slow the weakness in their currency. Other countries are doing some mild intervention. But, you know, not to be like the U.S. is everything, but for a major intervention to really have heft, the U.S. would have to be involved. We're, you know, so much of, you know, FX trading, part of it is priced in dollars. So, I mean, other countries could try to coordinate a little bit more, but what it seems like, and, you know, never say never, but the kind of 1985 style Plaza Accord, it, you know, it is in the cards now. We heard Brian Deese of the White House saying directly, I don't see that kind of thing. And Janet Yellen at Treasury, because Treasury is the folks who would intervene in the U.S. side, saying, hey, markets are working, you know, things aren't disorderly. So, of course, we're always surprised at times, but so far they're not giving us any inklings that they, you know, would do anything to counter the dollar.
Liz, help us understand just in the last 30 seconds that we have with you what this looks like going forward. And if any of the sources you spoke to, the currency traders and the economists, spelled out any sort of scenario where we could see the dollar actually weaken.
Well, you know, it's funny. We have a, not to preview this, but we have this survey the Bloomberg folks do, MLive Pulse, and it's looking at that. And a lot of these survey respondents, at least for their part, are saying, we think the dollar is going to keep strengthening. They even see some risk. Maybe they know something I don't know, that there could be some coordinated intervention. But it just seems like, at least for the time being, the Fed has laid out, you know, rates being, you know, 125 basis points higher by the end of the year. So I think the dollar is going to stay strong.
Interesting times, as you so well know. Liz McCormick, thank you so much. Bond and FX reporter at Bloomberg News, a must read here at Bloomberg, joining us via Zoom from New Jersey. This, by the way, the cover story of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week. Check it out. It is out. This is Bloomberg Radio.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Yeah.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 10 minutes left, actually about 9 minutes left in today's trading session. You heard Doug working down the equity trade. We're definitely off our lows of the session. In fact, we've seen some buying in the last half hour or so, but still down 2.8% on the NASDAQ. We're down about 2% on the S&P 500. And we have seen yields come off some of those higher levels. I'm just doing a quick check. That 10-year note with a yield of 3.75, shorter end of the yield curve, that 2-year at 4.16, so well above that 4%. So delighted to have with us Luca Paolini. He is chief strategist at Pictet Asset Management, and usually he's on the phone, but he's in our studio.
It's really good to have you here with us this afternoon, Luca. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I'm great to be here after so many months, and it's still not back to normal, but it's great to be here.
Well, something that is not normal are these markets.
Oh, that's for sure.
Yeah, help us understand what's going on here. I mean, we saw quite the rally yesterday, but a sell-off that's really taken away all the gains of yesterday.
Well, I think the simple story is, let's keep it simple.
Yeah.
We have very weak growth and very high interest rates, which is exactly the opposite of what we are seeing actually 2 years ago. This is why global stocks are at the same level of the end of 2019. So we have this COVID bubble, if you want, and now we're back to normal. When interest rates are being normalized, earnings are being downgraded. So it's, I think what was in a way strange, abnormal was, but I think the rally that we have seen during the pandemic, and now we're back to a more normal, let's say, less favorable environment.
You are someone who has seen market cycles, you know, reported on it, written about it. So does this market cycle, is there anything that you feel like we can draw on history that can help us understand maybe how this plays out ultimately?
Well, I know it's very fashionable to look at what happened in the 70s, right?
Higher
inflation, stagflation. I think the situation is very different. In the 70s, trend growth was much higher than now. So now we have much higher debt. Trend growth is lower. We are all older. On average, I think we are 10 years older than in the 60s or the 70s. So I don't like this comparison with the 70s. It's completely different. But also, we haven't seen, it's difficult to compare this cycle with the previous cycle because inflation is so high and interest rates, we tend to forget that. You know, look at the US, but even the UK, interest rates are well below the rate of inflation. So the idea that there is a lot of monetary tightening, but I mean, we haven't seen it really yet. And so
Do you think inflation comes down to where rates are, or rates have to go up to where inflation is today?
I think both. I really believe that inflation, especially in the U.S., has peaked. You look at the strength of the dollar, we keep inflation in check.
Yeah, we talked about
oil price has been falling. Supply chain have been easing. Retail sales in real terms are the same of 1 year ago. So I can see inflation falling. The question, though, is that there's probably not going to fall fast enough for central banks to stop the tightening cycle. And so this is why investors are nervous, because we have higher rates, weaker growth, which is exactly the opposite of what we have seen during COVID. And this is the market reaction.
Does it make sense, the weaker growth against that strong labor market? We got weekly jobless again here in the United States, and they came in lower than forecast. A reminder that, man, that labor market still continues to be really strong.
I have to admit that I'm very surprised by the resilience, actually the strength of the labor market in the U.S.
I think the Fed is, too.
All of us, right?
Well,
The Fed is probably saying, thank God, because I can continue.
Yeah, look, it's good news, right? It's good news. I want to say it's bad news when everybody has a job. The reality, though, is that this is a situation where it's difficult for the Fed to sound less hawkish when they're saying, look, we need to have the labor market back to normal. And on a weekly basis, we see basically jobless claims falling. And I don't think it's just kind of a strange data. This has been a trend that's been going on for some time. I'm very surprised, well, I have to say, by this.
I am too, but we are getting this anecdotal, and the jobs reports that we get each month are backward looking, and we really are seeing anecdotal evidence of this play out, especially in Silicon Valley. I mean, look at the Meta Platforms news, the company formerly known as Facebook, that we got earlier today, announcing a hiring freeze and warning employees of restructuring. So the company essentially saying, we're not going to backfill positions, we're not going to lay people off yet. When does that start to show up in the data?
And I think I agree. This is the kind of the concern that I have. We say the consumer is resilient because the labor market is resilient. But the labor market is, as we all know, the most lagging indicator of all. And of course, there has been, if you think about, a secular trend for labor market to be tighter for a number of reasons. So I wouldn't say I'm more optimistic about the U.S. economy because the labor market is stronger. I would say this is a lagging indicator. We have to take
this. But weekly jobless are pretty current data, right? It lags by a week. I mean, that's...
Yes, but it is true. But the nature of the labor market is to be lagging because companies, before they make a decision to hire, it's not something that you take every day. So it's just structural. But I agree that it sounds strange, but I have to say that in previous cycle, we have seen the labor market being basically the last thing to drop. So I think for me, the most important thing is to see actually what companies are doing. It's about investment. We tend to be overly kind of concerned about consumption, but investment is almost as important. And this is where I'm worried, because with earnings being under pressure,
right,
margin under pressure, investment will come under pressure. And with investment under pressure, the labor market will probably follow.
Well, I think it was Romain Bostic who talked about the number of stocks that, you know, we've seen hitting lows. I'm looking at JPMorgan Chase. Earnings are going to come out on October 14th. It'll be a big one in the morning. That stock hitting a 52-week low today. And I'm curious to see what Jamie Dimon has to say. Add all this up. You've got to help your clients. You've got to help them figure out how to make money in this environment. On our planning call, our team, our producer, Paul, shared with us that you like, in particular, I think, is it UK and Japan?
In terms of equities,
we have been reducing our weightings into the UK, but, you know, we tend to forget that the UK market is basically global. So 80% of UK stocks at their sales abroad. So a weaker pound actually helped them. That's why the UK market is doing well. Japan is a different story because it's cheap, no policy tightening, no inflation risk, and actually an economy that is quite resilient. I think, though, the main message for us is to reallocate into bonds, especially in the US. We think that the peak in bond yields is very close, and we think investors should consider bonds again after an horrendous, basically, 12
months. Was it Jeffrey Gunlock who talked about that too?
Yesterday.
That looking at the bond market
2 days ago,
and finding it interesting. So you do think we peaked in terms of yields?
We are very close. We are 4%, so we are not too far away from that.
All right, we got to run. Thank you so much, and great to have
you
here.
Thank you for having
Still
me.
Still not normal, but yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Maybe next time I come here.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed, yeah. I was just going to say that, Carol.
Luca Paolini, thank you so much. Chief Strategist at Pictet Asset Management. Great to have him here in our Interactive Brokers studio.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global and Schneider Electric. Visit BloombergLive.com/SBS2024 to learn more.